I do that on a bigger level with all my clients is we set a target of what does success look like, and then we work our way backwards. A lot of times business owners don't do that. They just wake up and their number one job for the day is to survive. So they'll get in and work all day and they didn't get any closer where they want to go because they don't know actually what success looks like.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your SMB spend without buying an ERP, but we are not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got Paul Maskell, the blue-collar CFO, as he has moniker calls himself. And today we're going to talk about how Paul has managed to build his practice, but also build equity in businesses as he's gone. So notoriously, selling your time for money is fine, but it's just that. And if you run a surface business like a fractional CFO business, how do you build equity and value as well at the same time? And this is something Paul has managed to do along the way. So we're going to chat about that. We're also going to chat about landscaping businesses, why they're particularly attractive for private equity. And yeah, Paul's got a few war stories to share with us about that for along the way. So Paul, thanks very much for coming along. Maybe you can open things up by telling us something about you that not many people know.
Yeah, thanks James for having me here. I'm super excited for the conversation. So a lot of people probably don't know since I've worked in finance a lot, own businesses a lot. So when I left the finance world, I left in 2010, left Chicago, used to work for big banks, watched everyone lose their jobs in 2008. I actually backpacked around South America for about 2.5 months.
Very cool.
So that was my segue into figuring out what I want to do next. I was leaving the corporate world and spent time in Colombia, Ecuador, Peru, and Bolivia. And then when I came back to the States, realized I don't really want to work for anybody else ever again.
Travel has that effect on you. I spent some time in Latin America and I met a guy who was cycling the length of Latin America. And he told me a story about how he went to this village, whatever, San Jose, you know, and he'd ask them, where are you going next? And he says, oh, I'm going to San Martin, you know, and they go, oh, they're very bad people over there. Watch out for the people in San Martin, you know. So, okay. So he cycled to San Martin. And they'd ask him where he'd come from. And they'd say, oh, San Jose. And they'd go, oh, they're very bad people over there. Did they rob you? You know, like, so there we go. Okay. Well, travel has that effect. It sort of opens your mind. You get out of route. So I guess we should, you know, qualify you as a guest on the show, ask you about how you got into finance, you know, and your early career. Was this something you dreamed as from a small boy, or how did you wind up working for a bank you mentioned there?
Yeah, it's a great question, James. So I don't think I'd ever dreamed of it as a small boy. Obviously, when you're a small kid, your first dreams are if you play sports, you want to be a professional athlete. So I played a lot of sports growing up, played golf, wanted to be a professional golfer, played basketball, played baseball. And my dad actually was in the trades. He owned his own hardwood floor company. I grew up in Michigan, which is a very blue collar area. And he was self-employed, one man band in, him and his van. If he wasn't working, no money was coming in, didn't have employees, didn't love the idea of having to train people, didn't trust other people, all the stuff, you know, that a lot of people complain about in that role. He was very successful at what he did, one of the best at it, did plenty of work for professional athletes and all the celebrities in Michigan and that type of stuff. So he said, don't do what I'm doing. Go to college, get good grades, and go work for a big corporation. At the same time, my mom was just getting into the finance world as well. So I was always good at math, loved numbers, loved that there was a definitive answer. I hated English and reading and all the stuff that's like theory-based where it's all open to interpretation. The numbers never lie. So growing up, that was what I was exposed to. And like I said, originally I wanted to be a professional golfer, played golf in college. And I wanted to be a professional golfer in the sense of working at a golf course, not a touring pro, but I wanted to be a head pro at a golf course. And then I started working at a golf course when I was 14. And I worked there from 14 until 21, basically through high school, through college, and realized I don't want to be a head pro at a golf course because the guy I worked for, he was there sun up till sundown, 7 days a week, never actually got to play golf. So I was like, well, that doesn't really make any sense if you're going to get into it because you like playing golf. So followed the, you know, what everyone tells you to do. So I went to school, got a finance degree, moved to Chicago. This was in 2007. Watched a lot of people in a lot of different banks that I knew lose their job in 2008. And to me, it just didn't seem like it was as safe as everybody said it was. Go work for somebody else, get the benefits, get the 401k, get the paid vacation, pension, all this stuff. And then I watched all these people who at the time, I was probably only 23, 24. I watched all these people who I thought were really old, which are now my age, 40, 50, 60 years old. They had been working there their entire life and they just got eliminated just like that. Like all the work they put in, all the goodwill they built was eliminated in more or less a day. So at that point, I realized I didn't want to work for somebody else. I quit my job. Like I said in the intro, something most people don't know. I quit my job, traveled around South America for a couple months, ended up in North Carolina when I came back. And that's when I made the decision of I'm not going to work for anybody else. So I had a finance background, but I wanted to run my own business. So over the last 15 years, since 2010, I have owned, scaled, sold 4 different companies, all local businesses here in the Raleigh, North Carolina area. Most recently was in the electrical business. I've spent the last 6 or 7 years in the trades. So I was a partner in a landscaping business, was a partner in an electrical business, exited that. And since then, I've been offering fractional CFO work to companies in the trades, focused on helping them with cash flow, creating predictability, scaling with confidence, sleeping well at night, all the things that come with when we actually have money in the bank.
Okay. So let me ask you then, started because you're with the bluecollaradvisors.com. Obviously, you've got taken a focus on blue collar business. So that's good news. So what's the best thing about a business, or what do you define as a blue collar business to start off with? And what's the best thing about, you know, those types of businesses?
Yeah. So I would say there's probably 3 things that really get me excited about. One, they're a little bit more resistant to what the economy is doing if you're not in the construction side of blue collar world. So if you're doing service work and repair work and working for homeowners, things are still going to break. Things are still going to need to get done. So that's one thing. The second thing maybe is actually at the top of it is giving people an opportunity that work in the trades to actually have the ability to turn it into a career. So growing up for a really long time, the world, society, teachers, colleges, everybody told you, you're an idiot, you're stupid, you don't know what you're doing if you don't go to college. Everyone's got to go to college. To me, that just doesn't make sense for a lot of people. Being a finance person, it really doesn't make sense to go $200,000 in debt if you don't want to go do that type of stuff. When really we can take people into the trades at 18, by 22, if they're really good, they're making $80,000 to $100,000 a year with no debt. And they have a skill that can't be outsourced to, you know, AI, it can't be outsourced overseas. So that's the second thing. And the third thing that I really love is historically, most trade companies aren't run very well. So I learned this from my dad. His calendar was always booked up because he just did a lot of things super simple. He answered the phone. If he missed the call, he called people back right away. Then when he set an initial appointment, he showed up when he said he was going to show up. Then when he was there, he laid out the expectations. This is what's going to happen next. I want to measure your home. And then I'm going to give you an estimate. And then if you want to approve it, I can come out this day. So he told them what they're going to do. And then he did it. And they were blown away. They're like, and his name's Paul too. So, oh my God, Paul, you know, answered the phone. He showed up when he said he was going to do. The price he gave to me, he stuck to that price. He showed up exactly when he said he was going to be to do the work. It was done when he said it was going to be done. And it's just amazing. So like all those things they say have nothing to do with actually what he did and what they paid him for. But historically, most companies, especially home service and trades companies, they're just not really good at that. So if we can do all that stuff and systematize all that stuff, we can then charge what we need to charge to hit the profitability that we need to hit in order to have a business that can allow us to do what we really want to do.
Okay, so absolutely 100% of the time that we need a plumber or someone or electrician or something else, my wife is around, we call then 3 people, 4 people, maybe one of them shows up. If they show up, then they may come back, they may not, like other things. So, and every time she says, you know what we should do? We should start generating leads and then we should start hiring, you know, these people. And we would make a killing, like, you know. So what's wrong with that thesis? Why couldn't anyone just like gather the leads and find some folks, give them an honest wage, and then just, you know, spin up a business? Isn't it super competitive?
Yeah, I mean, it's super competitive, but most people don't do it. So there's a huge opportunity there to build all that value, build that brand, build that goodwill. So then you can really start to grow a real business. I mean, usually it stems from the reason most companies don't do that is usually they're founder led. The founder is a really good technician, no matter what they do, electrical, plumbing, heating and air, wood floors, garage doors, all those things. Usually 99% of the time, the person who starts that company was the technician at another company who said, I think I can do this better.
Right.
So at first, they're great, right? They answer the phone because they're not that busy. They show up when they say they're going to show up because they're not that busy. They get the work done because they're not that busy. But then the fact that they're really good, all of a sudden they get busy and they don't know how to manage it. And usually, ironically, this is the Gross Profit Podcast. Usually they're not able to keep up because they're not charging enough to put the systems, processes, people in place to allow them to keep up. So when we start charging, when it's a one-man band, if I'm just going out and doing electrical work, I don't need to charge what a company needs to charge. A company that has software, a company that has someone answering the phone, a company that has all these vehicles and all the things that go into delivering a service. There's usually 75 to 100 expenses that go into just showing up to somebody's house that most homeowners don't know. So as we scale, our pricing usually doesn't go with it. And a lot of times that's just, we don't know we need to change our pricing. A lot of times it's ego. They're like, there's no way I could charge $350 an hour. But if we don't, we're not going to be able to deliver on our promises, be there when our customers need us again. So yeah, so you're 100% right. If we do all that and we're charging accordingly, there's plenty of opportunity there. Unfortunately, most people don't have their numbers dialed in, which is why I do what I do. We let numbers dictate what do we need to do instead of emotion, ego. Hey, I heard somebody on Facebook group, or I heard somebody at the supply shop said we should do this. We eliminate all that and we just use numbers to dictate what we need to do.
I'd like to ask you a bit about your dad, because your dad seems pretty switched on. He had the formula cracked for a great business, you know, and he chose not to scale because he sounds like a systems thinker to me. Like, he sounds like he had a way of doing it. He did it consistently, and that was sounds like the formula for success, maybe. But what do you think your dad attempted that, or he was just why do you, you know? Was there any learning there from what he, why did he end up saying, no, listen, I'm not even going to try?
Yeah, I think it worked out well for him. So when I'm working with any business, whether I own the business or it's my clients, we basically look at, there's three things that any customer can pick: speed, quality, and price. You can pick how quick you want it done. You can pick the cost, or you can pick how well it's done. Speed, quality, and price. But you can only pick two. So you can never have all three. You can't have the best thing, the cheapest thing, and the fastest all at once. Economy, people, it just doesn't work that way. So when you're building a business, you could compete on any two of those three. So if you're competing on speed and quality, there's going to be a premium with that. You're getting there really quickly and it's being done really well. We need to charge a premium because we need to find a lot of people who are really good at what they do, which we have to pay people a lot of money and all that. So those are the businesses I like to run. I like to help. We're competing on, we're the best and we're going to get out there quickly. If you want to compete on speed and price, usually you're like the handyman. You can get it done quickly. You can get it done cheaply, but quality is going to suffer. We're not an expert at anything. We're just kind of jack of all trades. Or we can be like what my dad was. My dad was the one-man band. He gets it done really well at a really affordable price. Now, if someone's really good at what they do and it's fairly affordable, that means he's going to be booked out for a couple of months. So if you're in an industry that allows that, luckily for my dad, he was hardwood floors. It wasn't like, I need these tomorrow. If he said, cool, once you pay your deposit, I'll reach out and get you on the schedule. Normally we're booked out 4 to 6 weeks. They're like, awesome. No issue there. So for him, it worked out really well. He was still able to make a really good living. He was really good at what he did. Everybody loved him. He didn't spend a dollar on advertising his entire career. It was all word of mouth, but he was booked out a couple months. We can't do that in a lot of trades like electrical, plumbing, HVAC. If you call a plumber and say, hey, I got a leak, and the plumber says, cool, I'll be out there in 3 days, they're like, I can't wait 3 days. You know what I mean? Or we're working on this renovation, I need this thing installed. Like, I used to be in the electrical space. So if someone called and said, hey, I just got an electric vehicle and I need the charger installed, if we say we're booked out a month, they're like, I'm not going to wait a month to charge my car. So it really depends on the industry. If you're doing like bigger projects, so like I have some window and door companies that I work with. They're usually booked out 8 to 12 weeks. Part of that is because it's the lead time of we got to order all the material. But then part of it is just a big ticket that takes a long time and there's a lot of moving parts. But if you're only putting windows and doors in once every 30 years, it's okay to wait 8 to 12 weeks. So I don't think there's a wrong model.
Right.
I think it depends on what type of business do you want to build. My caveat to all that, if you're the one-man band, your business isn't worth anything. So if your business isn't worth anything, you have to build wealth somewhere else. So ideally, you're making an excess income because you're really good at what you do and you don't have all the overhead and people and all that. what are we going to do with that excess income to build wealth when, you know, when we're no longer working because we can't have that exit?
Okay. So I've two questions then. The first one is, if you're, let's say your dad's situation, let's say similar to my dad's situation, right? So he's a professional, he's a lawyer, but like he, you know, more or less a one man band, and you know, works super hard, gets up at 7, works Sundays, and has been, you know, but it's actually worked out very well for him financially. But if you were to add, let's say, a second lawyer or a second plumber, you know, you're going to take a dip, right? It's not necessarily going to, you're not going to net out with more money. So how much bigger do you need to aim to go before you can expect to be doing more than you would have just by yourself, roughly speaking?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, James. So if you follow the book Buy Back Your Time by Dan Martell, he says most solopreneurs get stuck around the $300,000 mark. So you're doing $25,000 to $30,000 a month, delivering it all in your own time and all that. We can kind of creep that up. If say we're doing $25,000 a month and we have one client that's underpaying, the next time we bring on a client, if we're maxed out, we can get rid of that client at the bottom and slowly work our way up. Maybe we're doing $350,000, $400,000. But at some point, you know, we have to make that decision of, are we good with this? Which again, there's nothing wrong with that. If you're making $300,000 to $400,000 a year,
sure,
and you're happy, you've got a lifestyle business, there is absolutely nothing wrong with that. If you can live off, call it 200 and put 200 away to build wealth elsewhere, however you do that, there's nothing wrong with that. If you want to take it to the next level, then it's, what do we need to charge? What do we want our gross profit to be? So if you're in the attorney space and you know a good attorney can generate $30,000 a month in revenue, can we get by with a 50% gross profit and pay that attorney $15,000 a month? If so, we're already probably pretty good with our pricing. If we're like, no, we couldn't get anybody good at $15,000 a month, then we probably know, well, we got to start raising our rates, raising what we charge. Maybe instead of we're billing by the hour, we're just doing like fixed price to set up a business that might take, you know, a lot of times attorneys and professionals, they do by the hour, but the better they get at it, they're actually making less money. So that model doesn't work. So can we start doing some fixed pricing on things of, hey, if we're going to set up an operating agreement, it's a flat fee of $2,000. 10 years ago, it might've taken me 10 hours. Now it takes me 2 because I got a template. The customer doesn't care because it takes the customer 4 weeks to do it. You know, so I think that's where we have to make that decision of, where do we want to go with this? What's the end goal? And I mean, I do that on a bigger level with all my clients, is we set a target of what does success look like, and then we work our way backwards. A lot of times business owners don't do that. They just wake up and their number one job for the day is to survive. So they'll get in and work all day and they didn't get any closer where they want to go because they don't know where actually what success looks like.
So let me bring you back. You came out of your ayahuasca tent in South America or whatever you were doing down there, and you realized, no, I'm not going to work for the bank. Never going into the belly of the beast again. You came back to the US. You came up with an interesting opportunity. You didn't just, as far as I know, you start working. You found a business to get involved with. So tell us about this business and how did you identify? Where was it when you got there? How did you set it up?
So I mentioned 20 minutes ago, my biggest passion growing up was I wanted to be in the golf world. I want to be a professional golfer. I love golf. Love all the things about it, what it can do for you, all that good stuff. Realized I didn't want to be a head professional at a golf course. So my first business was actually, we were running after school golf programs for elementary kids. We would go to their school. We would use a ball that was safe to hit on school campus, and we would run golf programs. And the whole idea behind that was making golf as accessible as all other youth sports. You can play soccer, football, basketball, baseball really easily in most of America. Golf has always been seen as an elitist sport. Mm-hmm. You got to have a lot of money. You got to live in the right neighborhood. Your parents got to do this. So we made it super affordable, provided all the equipment. You could play golf for basically $100 for every 6 weeks. So you can come to golf class for $15 to $20. And then our goal was to then transition them to golf courses through golf camps, parent-child events, junior golf leagues, and all that. So that was my first business. To be honest, it was a passion play. So it was a startup franchise. Still remember, I was in the Detroit airport flipping through the Entrepreneur magazine and came across this franchise opportunity. And I looked at it, and I was living in Raleigh, North Carolina at the time, which is a big golf area, good weather for golf all year round. And I was like, there's definitely already a franchise here. There wasn't, which was awesome. So I started up that franchise here, grew it. We added tennis. So then it became golf and tennis. We ended up owning 4 franchises. So scaled that up. After like 4 years, I sold it. And then the franchisor actually hired me to go teach other people to do what we did. Because it was fairly new franchise. So within 4 years, we became I think the second or third largest in the country. So then I was tasked with going to teach other people how to run their business using numbers, systems, processes, building teams, all that. And then anytime a new franchisee came on board, I was in charge of getting them up and running. So that was kind of my first foray into the entrepreneurial world. And then, like I said, from there, I've kind of transitioned over time to just focus solely on the trades. What I learned from that, which I think could be a big takeaway for anybody, is I had 44 part-time employees when we sold. Those 44 employees on average usually work like 5 to 7 hours a week. So I was managing a ton of people that weren't really working a lot. And no matter how often people are working, you still got to manage them. So what I started to look at from a numbers standpoint is what industries have the highest revenue per employee so I can manage less people in order to get to where I want to go. So like that was the biggest takeaway. So now like if I look at the trades, most companies in the trades can do, I would say, between $200,000 and $400,000 in revenue per employee, which is a lot better than like $10,000 per employee when I started.
Interesting. Okay. So you identified you wanted to get into a trade and then you approached someone who had a small trade business and you talked to them about going into partnership. Is that right?
Yeah. So once I started getting into the trade, James, I first partnered up with a landscaping business and the conversation more went like this. First, I was consulting them. And like at this time in my career, I was owning a business, but then doing like, they're all local business at the time that I was consulting. There's a local business I knew needed help. I would go in and help them from a numbers standpoint and an operational standpoint. So started working with them. They realized we need you more because we actually need somebody to like come in and like start building these things. Like conversations are great. What you're telling me is great. Tracking this stuff is great. But we actually need someone to come in and build this with us. So I partnered up with that landscaping business, did that for about three and a half years, somewhere around there. And then from there, made a transition into a similar setup with the electrical company that I referenced earlier. I was consulting them, systems, processes, numbers. They were struggling to scale. The founder was the electrician, great electrician. Like everybody knew he was an awesome electrician. Great Google reviews, but wasn't able to scale because he was still out in the field a lot. So I came in as a 50-50 partner. We scaled it up, put the team in place, systems, processes, technology, numbers, all those things. And then 3 years after that, he actually bought me back out, took full control back to the company, which is when I started doing fractional CFO work.
Let's talk about that deal because like getting someone to sell part of the business or give equity away is a, it's a big ask, right? It's a difficult thing to sort of persuade someone to do. If you want a smaller part of a bigger pie and all those arguments kind of make sense. But at the same time, sounds like you've done it twice now. You've got people, not a small chunk, like giving away 50% equity in their business in order to come in and grow it. So what would it, how do you construct that deal to make it look like a good deal for them? Because if you give 50% away and you just say, okay, good luck, I've got my 50%, you could do nothing and it would be a disaster. So how'd you put the deal together? What would it look like?
Yeah, that's a great question, James. And I, to me, starting with the end in mind, it starts with your visions have to align. If that owner doesn't want to scale it to a point where it makes financial sense, then it just doesn't make financial sense. Mm-hmm. But if they say, I want to get to $10 million in revenue, there's no way I can get to that on my own. And in fact, there's no way I can get to $5 million on my own. Well, then it starts to make financial sense of like, well, if we do this together, we could get to $10 million. You can focus on the trade side of things. I'll focus on the operations and finance side of things. And we can really accelerate the growth. And that's what we did, to be honest. So we grew it by, I think, like 500% in 3 years, became very successful, you know, and now it's set up. All the things are in place to take it to the next level. And I think it, a lot of it comes also with ego. So a lot of people in general, not just in the trades, but a lot of founders of businesses believe their business is, you know, worth a lot more than maybe it is. And they have a hard time admitting that they need help. They have a hard time being vulnerable, like, I just can't do this on my own. I don't see a way out of this. And like I said, it goes back to the vision. So like where my dad got stuck, he wasn't really stuck. That's what he wanted to do. He wanted to be the one-man band, booked out a couple months, charge what he needs to charge, live a great life, all those things. Other people are like, I want to get this to $10 million. I want to get this to $5 million. And if the numbers make sense, then it's a lot easier to have that conversation. And I think the other part to that is in both scenarios, we worked together before we made that decision. It's a lot harder when it's like, James, give me 50% of your business. I know what the problems are and I'll fix them. James is gonna be like, I don't even know you. Why would I all of a sudden go, you know, basically get into marriage with you? You know, if I don't even know you. So a lot of times people on the other side of that kind of jump the gun, I would say, of like, hey, cool. As long as I know what you need to do, let's go make it happen. I've seen a lot of those go sideways. So taking the time to get to know people, get to know the business, get to know the personalities, all those things will make it a lot easier.
Okay, that's interesting. So I was kind of expecting you to say something like, well, you know, if we didn't hit certain targets, I wouldn't get any equity, or was there any of that? Or had you built enough trust to be able to, this guy to be able to say, no, listen, I know Paul, I believe in him, let's do it.
Yeah, I think, and you can set it up a lot of different ways. So there's some people that set up like things like phantom equity. I mean, like the better we do, the more percentage you'll get. Other ones are just be like, cool, let's do it. So I think that goes back to what I just said of, if they really know you, you don't have to put all those parameters in place. If they're like, I don't really know this guy, so let's hedge my bets and protect my side, I'm going to put in all these parameters, hoops, hurdles, benchmarks, all that. So there's plenty of ways to do it. I would say there's more ways now than ever, just because it's becoming more, you know.
Okay, so step one.
The whole entrepreneur.
Step one.
What's step one?
Step one, be a business genius. Step two, have people offer business. Is after business to you. Like that's the technique I'm hearing here.
Well, yeah, like, I mean, it goes back to anything of like, you got to provide a lot of value before you can expect anything in return, where a lot of people, it's just like, they don't want to put in the time to build that value first. You know, to me, being a numbers person, the numbers don't lie. So if you can show me what we can do and you've done it, that makes it a little bit easier. There's plenty of people out there now that are leaving their IT jobs and never owned a business and think they can go run an HVAC business.
Okay, so we're about 40 minutes deep here, 30 minutes deep at this stage. So there's hardly anyone left, Paul. It's just you and me, basically, right? So you can now tell me, give me the secret. What's your go-to move that allows you to be confident? Because the other side of it is you're going to put all this effort into a business, right? I'm assuming you're taking equity. You're not going to get a ton of cash. You know, there's plenty of opportunities out there to invest in, maybe, for a guy like you. So what's your go-to move? Like, I'll tell you what my go-to move is. It's very simple. When a lead calls, when a lead registers, call them straight away. Like, that's it. That's the end of it, you know? Like, just be the first guy to call them before anyone else does. And that's how I built any business, basically. So now you've got all my secrets. Give me yours. What's your go-to move?
Yeah. So, I mean, like now I don't own any other business beside my own, besides offering fractional CFO work. So I don't know, like, if I got back into that world, what it is, but to me, it's the same thing. What we said about how do we build a home service company by doing exactly what you said, we deliver an awesome customer experience. So even now when somebody reaches out to me and they book a call, I get a text message alert saying, hey, James just booked a call with you to discuss what's going right and wrong in his business. I will then record a video and say, hey, James, it's Paul. Super excited that you reached out, saw that we're scheduled to talk next Tuesday at 10 a.m. Really looking forward to the conversation, learn more about you, your business, and your goals. If you need anything before next Tuesday at 10 a.m., please let me know. Otherwise, chat then. So there's some good resources for people out there. How to Never Lose a Customer by Joey Coleman's a great book. Fans First by Jesse Cole, the owner of Savannah Bananas, is a great book. Giftology by John Rulin is a great book. So how do we set ourselves apart, knowing that the service or product that we offer is more or less a commodity? The world is flat. Thousands of people offer the service I offer. If you're operating in your local market and you need a plumber, there's probably 60 plumbers that could make it to your house just based on geography. So how do we set ourselves apart, get people talking about us, make them feel good, make them trust us, make them want to do business with us? It's doing all the small things that just take time to show that you care.
Awesome. I think this has been a fantastic discussion. I have to say, I think I could talk to you for another hour. It's clear that you really got the goods here. So tell us, who should reach out to you, Paul, and how can they go about doing it?
Yeah. So really, I mean, anybody can reach out to me. You can find me on LinkedIn, social media, all that. But if you own a company in the trade, so you own a home service company, blue collar business, if you just go to thebluecollaradvisors.com/price, so thebluecollaradvisors.com/price, that'll take you to a pricing calculator that it's super in-depth yet simple. It's got a video, it's got a PDF, all the good stuff. Because what I realized is the number one problem with most home service companies is they're not priced properly. And that's the first point money comes into your business. So if it comes in wrong, the trickle-down effect is massive. So free pricing calculator, video walkthrough, all the good stuff, thebluecollaradvisors.com/price.
Awesome. Thanks very much. And thank you for listening. If you've been listening this far into the show, congratulations. Your special reward is to be able to go to procurementexpress.com/mastermind, but only if you're a fractional CFO. That is because once a month we run a mastermind for fractional CFOs exclusively. We bring you in. You don't have to listen to me. What we do is we put you in a group with three or four of your peers from around the world. Some will be a few steps ahead of you, maybe like Paul, maybe there's some a few steps behind you, and you get to brainstorm, practice some business problems that you're facing in your own business and your customers are facing. It's a big hit. It's always good fun and entertaining. So I recommend that you tap on that. And that's it. Thanks for listening. Thanks, Paul.
Thanks, James.